"Which means 10 between me and that prize," thought Coriolanus as he watched an Avox remove Iphigenia's chair. He wished he could get food and water to Lucy Gray. What would happen if he sent it in without knowing her location? On screen, the pack collected Sol's, or Sal's, food and moved back toward the tunnels, probably to get some rest before the night came. Should he risk it now? He discussed it in whispers with Lysistrata, who felt that it might be worth a try if they sent in drones together.
"We don't want them getting too weak and dehydrated. I don't think Jessup's gotten anything down in days. Let's wait and see if they try and contact us. Let's give them until the supper break."
But Lucy Gray made an entrance just as the student body was being released to go home. She darted out of a tunnel, running at full pitch, her hair loosening from her braids and flying free behind her.
"Where's Jessup?" said Lysistrata with a frown. "Why aren't they together?"
Before Coriolanus could venture a guess, Jessup staggered out of the same tunnel Lucy Gray had fled from. At first, Coriolanus thought he had been wounded, possibly while defending Lucy Gray. But then, what accounted for her flight? Were other tributes in pursuit? As the camera moved in on Jessup, it became apparent that he was ill, not hurt. Stiff-limbed and feverish with excitement, he swiped at the sun a few times before crouching down and springing almost immediately back to his feet for his first close-up. Coriolanus wondered if Lucy Gray had found a way to poison him, but that didn't make sense. Jessup was too valuable as a protector, especially with the pack that had formed last night running around. What, then, ailed him? Any number of things could have sickened him, any range of maladies been suspected, if it hadn't been for the telltale foam that began to bubble over his lips. Chapter 17.
"He's rabid," Lysistrata said softly.
Rabies had made a comeback in the capital during the war. With doctors needed in the field and facilities and supply lines compromised by the bombings, medical treatment had become sketchy for humans, like Coriolanus's mother, and almost non-existent for the pampered capital pets. Vaccinating your cat wasn't on the list of priorities when you couldn't scrape up enough money for bread. How it began remained a matter of debate. An infected coyote from the mountains? A nocturnal encounter with a bat? But the dogs spread it. Most of them were starving, abandoned casualties of the war themselves, from dog to dog and then to people. The virulent strain developed with unprecedented speed, killing over a dozen capital citizens before a vaccination program brought it under control. Coriolanus remembered the posters alerting people to the warning signs in animals and humans alike, adding just one more potential threat to his world. He thought of Jessup with his handkerchief pressed against his neck. The rat bite?
"Not a rat," said Lysistrata, shock and sadness on her face. "Rats almost never spread rabies. Probably one of those mangy raccoons."
"Lucy Gray said he mentioned fur, so I'd assumed..." He trailed off. Not that it mattered what had bitten Jessup. It was a death sentence any way you sliced it. He must have been infected about 2 weeks ago. It was fast, wasn't it?
"Very fast. Because he was bit in the neck, the quicker it gets to the brain, the quicker you die," Lysistrata explained. "And of course, he's half starved and weak."
If she said so, it was probably true. This was just the sort of thing he imagined the Vickers family discussing over dinner in their calm, clinical manner.
"Poor Jessup," said Lysistrata. "Even his death has to be horrible."
The recognition of Jessup's illness put the audience on edge, setting off a wave of comments thick with fear and revulsion.
"Rabies? How did he get that?
Brought it from the districts, I'll bet. Great, now we'll infect the whole city."
All the students dropped back into their seats, not wanting to miss anything, dredging up childhood memories of the disease. Coriolanus stayed silent in solidarity with Lysistrata, but his concern grew as Jessup zigzagged across the arena in Lucy Gray's direction. No telling what was going on in his mind. Under normal circumstances, Coriolanus was certain he'd protect her, but he'd clearly lost his reason if she'd run for her life. The cameras tracked Lucy Gray as she sprinted across the arena, and began to scramble up the broken wall into the stands holding the main press box. Positioned midway in the arena, it occupied several rows and had somehow been spared in the bombing. She stopped a moment, panting, while she considered Jessup's erratic pursuit. Then she made for the debris of a nearby concession stand. The skeleton of the frame remained, but the center had been blasted into bits and the roof had been flung 30 feet away. Strewn with bricks and boards, the area presented a sort of obstacle course that she traversed until she planted herself at the top of the mess. The game makers took advantage of her stillness and zoomed in for a close-up. Coriolanus took one look at her cracked lips and reached for his communicuff. She appeared to have had no access to water since she'd been left in the arena, and that had been a day and a half ago. He punched in the order for a bottle of water. The promptness of the drone delivery was improving with each request. Even if she had to keep running, they would be able to get the water to her if she stayed in the open. If she could escape Jessup, Coriolanus would load her up with both food and drink, for her own use and to lace with the rat poison. But that seemed like a long-term plan at the moment. Jessup had made his way across the arena and seemed confused by Lucy Gray's rejection. He began to climb after her into the stands, but he had trouble keeping his balance. As he entered the field of debris, his coordination diminished further, and twice he fell with great force, opening gashes on his knee and temple. After the second wound, which generated a fair amount of blood, he sat, somewhat stunned, on a step, reaching out to her. His mouth moved while the foam began dripping from his chin. Lucy Gray remained motionless, watching Jessup with a pained expression. They created a strange tableau. Rabid boy, trapped girl, bombed out building. It suggested a tale that could only end in tragedy, star-crossed lovers meeting their fate. A revenge story turned in on itself. A war saga that took no prisoners. Please die, Coriolanus thought. What eventually killed you when you had rabies? You couldn't breathe, or maybe your heart stopped? Whatever it was, the sooner it happened to Jessup, the better it was for everyone involved. A drone carrying a bottle of water flew into the arena, and Lucy Gray lifted her face to track its wobbly progress. Her tongue flicked across her lips as if in anticipation. However, as it passed over Jessup's head, something registered and a shudder racked his body. He swung at it with a board, and the drone crashed into the stands. The water pooling out of the cracked bottle sent him into a state of heightened agitation. He backed away, tripping over the seats, and then made straight for Lucy Gray. She, in turn, began to climb even higher. Coriolanus panicked. While the strategy of putting the wreckage between herself and Jessup had some merit, she was in danger of being cut off from the field. The virus may have compromised Jessup's movement, but it also loaned a manic speed to his powerful body, and nothing distracted him from Lucy Gray. Except that moment with the water, he thought. The water. A word surfaced in his brain. A word from the poster that had papered the Capitol for a time. Hydrophobia. A fear of water. The inability to swallow made rabies victims go wild at the sight of it. His fingers began to work his communicuff to order bottles of water. Perhaps enough of them would frighten Jessup away. He would drain his bank if he had to. Lysistrata placed her hand on his, stopping him. No, let me. He's my tribute, after all. She began to order bottle after bottle, sending in the water to drive Jessup over the brink. Her face registered little emotion, but a single tear slid down her cheek, just kissing the edge of her mouth before she brushed it away. Lissy. He hadn't called her that since they were tiny. You don't have to. If Jessup can't win, I want Lucy Gray to. That's what he'd want. And she can't win if he kills her, she said. Which might happen anyway. On screen, Coriolanus could see that Lucy Gray had indeed worked herself into a tough spot. To her left stood the high back wall of the arena. To her right, the thick glass side of the press box. As Jessup continued his pursuit, she made several attempts to escape him, but he kept correcting his course to block her. When he came within 20 feet, she began to talk to him, putting her hand out in a soothing manner. It stopped him, but only momentarily, and he made for her again. Far across the arena, the first bottle of Lysistrata's water, or perhaps the replacement for the one that had crashed, began its flight toward the tributes. This machine seemed steadier and truer in course, as did the small fleet that followed it. The moment Lucy Gray spied the drones, she stopped her retreat. Coriolanus saw her hand pat the ruffles of her skirt over the pocket with the silver compact, and he took it as a sign that she had grasped the significance of the water. She pointed over at the drones, beginning to shout, and succeeded in getting Jessup to turn his head. Jessup froze, and his eyes bulged with fear. As the drones closed in on him, he pawed at them, but failed to connect. When they started releasing the bottles of water, he lost all control. Explosive devices could not have elicited a stronger response, and the impact of the bottles smacking into the seats whipped him into a frenzy. The contents of one splattered his hand, and he recoiled as if it were acid. He gained the aisle and bounded down toward the field, but another dozen drones arrived and bombarded him. Since they were directed to deliver right to the tribute, there was no escaping them. As he flew down toward the front row seats, his foot caught, and he tripped forward, hurtling over the arena wall and onto the field. The sound of snapping bones that accompanied his landing surprised the audience, as Jessup had landed in a rare pocket of the arena with good audio. He lay on his back, motionless except for the heaving in his chest. The remaining bottles rained down on him while his lips curled back and his eyes stared unblinkingly at the bright sun glinting off the water. Lucy Gray darted down the steps and hung over the railing.
Jessup!
The most he could do was shift his gaze to her face. Coriolanus could barely hear Lysistrata whisper,
"Oh, don't let him die alone."
Weighing the danger, Lucy Gray took a moment to assess the empty arena before she picked her way down the broken wall to his side. Coriolanus wanted to groan. She needed to get out of there, but he couldn't do it with Lysistrata beside him. "She won't," he reassured Lysistrata, thinking of how Lucy Gray had dragged the burning beam from his body.
"It's not her style."
"I've got some money left," said Lysistrata, wiping her eyes. "I'll send some food."
Jessup followed Lucy Gray with his eyes as she jumped the last yard to the field, but he seemed unable to move. Was he paralyzed by the fall? She approached him with caution and knelt just out of reach of his long arms. Trying to smile, she said,
"You go to sleep now, you hear, Jessup? You go on. It's my turn to stand guard."
Something seemed to register. Her voice, or perhaps the repetition of words she'd spoken to him over the past 2 weeks. The rigidity eased in his face, and his eyelids fluttered.
"That's right. Let yourself go. How are you going to dream if you don't go to sleep?"
Lucy Gray scooted forward and laid a hand on his head.
"It's okay. I'll watch over you. I'm right here. I'm staying right here."
Jessup stared at her fixedly as the life slowly ebbed out of his body and his chest became still. Lucy Gray smoothed his bangs and sat back on her heels. She heaved a deep sigh, and Coriolanus could feel her exhaustion. She shook her head as if to wake herself, then grabbed the nearest bottle of water, twisting off the top and draining it in a few gulps. A second followed, then a third before she wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. She stood up and examined Jessup, then opened another bottle and poured it over his face, washing away the foam and spittle. From her pocket, she took the white linen napkin that had lined the picnic box Coriolanus brought her the final night. She leaned down and used the edge to gently shut his eyelids, then shook out the cloth and covered his face to hide it from the audience. The food parcels from Lysistrata thumping down around her seemed to bring Lucy Gray back to the moment, and she quickly scooped up the pieces of bread and cheese and stuffed them in her pockets. She gathered the bottles of water in her skirt, but pulled up short as Reaper appeared at the far end of the arena. Lucy Gray lost no time in vanishing into the nearest tunnel with her gifts. Reaper let her go, but walked over to collect the last few water bottles and the fading light, taking note of Jessup, but leaving his body alone. Coriolanus thought it might bode well for later. If the tributes kept making a habit of scavenging the gifts of the fallen, they'd play right into the poisoning plan. He didn't have much time to dwell on it, though, as Lepidus arrived to claim Lysistrata. "Whoa," Lepidus said. "That was unexpected. Did you know about the rabies?"
"Of course not. I would have alerted the authorities so they could test the raccoons in the zoo," she said.
"What? You mean he didn't bring it from the districts?" said Lepidus. Lysistrata was firm.
"No, he was bitten here in the capital."
"At the zoo?" Lepidus looked worried. "A lot of us have been spending time at the zoo. A raccoon was over by my equipment, you know, scratching around with those weird little hands and..."
"You don't have rabies,"
Lysistrata said flatly. Lepidus made a clawing motion with his fingers. It was touching my things.
"Did you have any questions about Jessup?" she asked.
"Jessup? No, I never got near him." "You meant, did you have any thoughts?" he asked.
"I do."
She took a deep breath.
"What I'd like people to know about Jessup is that he was a good person. He threw his body over mine to protect me when the bombs started going off in the arena. It wasn't even conscious. He did it reflexively. That's who he was at heart, a protector. I don't think he would have ever won the games, because he'd have died trying to protect Lucy Gray."
"Oh, like a dog or something," Lepidus nodded. "A really good one."
"No, not like a dog. Like a human being," said Lysistrata.
Lepidus eyed her, trying to decipher whether she was joking. "Huh. Lucky, any thoughts from headquarters?" The camera caught Lucky gnawing on a stubborn hangnail. "Oh, what? Hey! Nothing upstairs at present. Let's peek back at the arena, shall we?" With the cameras averted, Lysistrata began to collect her things.
"Don't go yet. Stay for dinner with us," Coriolanus said.
"Oh, no. I just want to go home. But thanks for being there, Corio. You're a good ally," she said.
He hugged her.
"You are. I know that wasn't easy." She sighed.
"Well, at least I'm out of it."
The other mentors gathered around her, saying good job and whatever, before she left the hall without waiting for the rest of the student body to head out. That was soon to follow, and within a few minutes the 10 remaining mentors were all that was left behind. They examined one another with new eyes now that the plinth prize was in play, each hoping not just to have a victor, but to be a victor in the games. The same thought must have occurred to the game makers, because Lucky reclaimed the screen to do a rundown of the remaining tributes and their mentors. A split screen showed photos of the pairing side by side, accompanied by his voiceover. Some of the mentors groaned when they realized their unflattering student ID photos had been downloaded, but Coriolanus felt relieved that they weren't highlighting his current scabby face. The tributes, who had no official photographs, showed up in random shots taken since the reaping. The list went chronologically by district, starting with District 3's Urban Tesley and Io Cirque pairings. "Our tech district tributes have us all wondering, what did they do with those drones?" said Lucky. Festus and Coral appeared next, followed by Persephone and Mizzen. "The District 4 tributes are sailing high as we entered the final 10. Lamina on her beam and Pup's photo brought a cheer from Pup until it was replaced by Treach juggling at the zoo and Vipsania. And crowd favorites Lamina and Plenty Harrington are joined by the District 7 boy, Treach, and his mentor, Vipsania Sickle. So, Districts 3, 4, and 7 all have both their teams intact. Now to the solo tributes." A blurry picture of Wovi crouched down at the zoo, coupled with Hilarius with a bad acne outbreak. "Wovi from 8 with Hilarius Heavensby as a guide." Since they used his interview shot, Tenor looked better as he came up side by side with Demetia. "The boy from 10 can't wait to put his slaughterhouse techniques to good use." Then Reaper, standing strong in the arena, matched with a flawless-looking Clemencia. "Here's a tribute you might want to rethink. Reaper from 11. Finally, Coriolanus saw his own photo. Not great, not bad, with a dazzling photo of Lucy Gray singing at the interview. And the award for most popular goes to Coriolanus Snow and Lucy Gray from 12. Most popular? It was flattering, Coriolanus supposed, but not especially intimidating. Never mind, though. Popular had gotten Lucy Gray a pile of money. She was alive, watered, fed, and well-stocked. Hopefully she could hole up while the others thinned their ranks. Losing Jessup as her protector was a blow, but it would be easier for her to hide by herself. Coriolanus had promised her she would never really be alone in the arena, that he would be with her all the way. Was she holding on to that compact now, thinking of him as he was of her? Coriolanus updated his mentor sheet, taking no pleasure in crossing out Jessup and Lysistrata, along with Bobbin, Dill, and the girl from District 5. The field had narrowed considerably, but several of the surviving tributes would be tough to beat. Reaper, Tanner, both of those District 4 tributes, and who knew what that brainy little pair from District 3 was up to. As the 10 mentors gathered for a delicious lamb stew with dried plums, Coriolanus missed Lysistrata. She had been his only real ally, just as Jessup had been Lucy Gray's. After supper, he sat between Festus and Hilarius, doing his best to keep from nodding off. At around 9, with nothing eventful having happened since Jessup's death, they were sent home with orders to be there all the earlier the following morning. The walk home loomed, but he remembered the second token from Tigris and gratefully mounted the trolley which dropped him a block from his apartment. The grand mam had gone to bed, but Tigris waited for him in his bedroom, again enveloped in her mother's fur coat. He collapsed on the chaise lounge at her feet, knowing he owed her an explanation of his time in the arena. It wasn't only fatigue that made him hesitate. "I know you want to hear about last night," he told her. "But I'm afraid to tell you. I'm afraid you could get in trouble for knowing it."
"It's okay, Corio. Your shirt's told me most of it."
From the floor, she retrieved the shirt he'd worn in the arena.
"Clothes speak to me, you know?"
She smoothed it out on her lap and began to reconstruct the terrors of his night, first lifting the bloodstained slit in the material on the sleeve.
"Right here. This is where the knife cut you."
Her fingers tracked the damage down the fabric.
"All these little rips, and the way the dirt's ground in, tell me you slid, or maybe even were dragged, which matches up with the scrape on your chin and the blood on your collar."
Tigris touched the neckline, then moved on.
"This other sleeve, the way it's torn, I'd say you caught it on barbed wire, probably at the barricade. But this blood here, the stuff splattered on the cuff, I don't think it's yours. I think you had to do something really awful in there."
Coriolanus stared down at the blood and felt the impact of the beam on Bobbin's head. "Tigris?" She rubbed her temple.
"And I keep wondering how it came to this. That my baby cousin, who wouldn't hurt a fly, has to fight for his life in the arena."
This was the last conversation in the world he wanted to have right now.
"I don't know. I didn't have any choice."
"I know that. Of course I know that."
Tigris put her arms around him.
"I just hate what they're doing to you."
"I'm okay," he said. "It won't last much longer, and even if I don't win, I'm a shoo-in for some sort of prize. Really, I think things are about to take a turn for the better."
"Right, yes, I'm sure they are. Snow lands on top,"
she agreed. But the look on her face spoke otherwise.
"What is it?" he asked.
She shook her head.
"Come on, what?" "I wasn't going to tell you until after the Hunger Games."
She fell silent. "But now you have to," he said.
"Or I'll imagine the worst things possible. Please, just tell me." "We'll figure something out."
She started to rise. "Tigris?" He pulled her back down.
"What?"
Tigris reluctantly reached into her coat pocket, pulled out a letter marked with a capital stamp, and handed it to him.
"The tax bill came today."
She didn't have to elaborate. Her expression told him everything. With no money for the taxes and no way to borrow more, the Snows were about to lose their home. Chapter 18. Coriolanus had been in a state of denial about the taxes, but now the reality of his family's displacement hit him like a truck. How could he say goodbye to the only home he'd ever known? To his mother, to his childhood, to those sweet memories of his life before the war. These four walls not only kept his family safe from the world, they protected the legend of the Snows' wealth. He would be losing his residence, his history, and his identity in one fell swoop. They had 6 weeks to come up with the money, to scrape together the equivalent of Tigris's income for the whole year. The cousins tried to assess what they might still have to sell, but even if they sold every stick of furniture and every keepsake, it would only cover a few months at the most. And the tax bills would keep showing up every month like clockwork. They would need the proceeds from selling their possessions, however paltry, to rent a new place. Eviction due to tax troubles had to be avoided at all cost. The public shame would be too great, too lasting. So move they must. "What are we going to do?" Coriolanus asked.
"Nothing until the Hunger Games are finished. You have to focus on them so you can get that plinth prize, or at least another one. I'll handle this end," she said firmly.
She made him a cup of hot milk laced with corn syrup and stroked his throbbing head until he fell asleep. He dreamed violent, unsettling things, replaying the events of the arena, and awoke to the usual.
"Gem of Panem, mighty city, through the ages you shine anew."
Would the grandmam still be singing it in their rental in a month or two? Or would she be too humiliated to raise her voice again? For all his derision of the morning recital, the thought saddened him. As he dressed, the stitches on his arm pulled, and he remembered he was supposed to drop by the Citadel to get them checked. Dark red scabs had settled on his scraped face, but the swelling had abated. He dabbed some of his mother's powder on, and while it didn't really cover the scabs, the scent soothed him a bit. Their hopeless financial situation made him accept the tokens Tigris offered without hesitation. Why bother pinching pennies when the dollars had fled long ago? On the trolley, he choked down his nut butter on soda crackers and tried not to compare it with Ma Plinth's breakfast rolls. It crossed his mind that given his rescue of Sejanus, the Plinths might provide a loan or even a payout for his silence, but the grandmam would never allow that, and the idea of a Snow groveling before a Plinth was unthinkable. The Plinth prize, though, was fair game, and Tigris was right. These next few days would determine his future. At the academy, the 10 mentors drank their tea and readied themselves for the cameras. Every day brought them more scrutiny. The game makers had sent over a makeup person who managed to tone down Coriolanus's scabs and give his eyebrows a little shape while she was at it. No one seemed in the mood to talk about the games directly, except Hilarius Heavensby, who could talk of nothing else.
"It's different for me," said Hilarius. "I checked my list last night. Every single one of the tributes left has had food, or at least water, since they've been in the arena, except old no-show Wovi. Where is she, anyway? I mean, how would I know if she just curled up and died somewhere in those tunnels? Maybe she's already dead, and I'm just sitting here like a jackass playing with my communicuff."
Coriolanus wanted to tell him to shut up because other people had real problems, but instead he maneuvered himself into a seat on the end next to Festus, who was deep in discussion with Persephone. Lucky Flickerman opened by recapping the remaining tributes and inviting Lepidus to take comments from the mentor pool. Coriolanus was called upon first thing to respond to the Jessup scare. He made a point of complimenting Lysistrata's brilliant handling of the rabies situation and thanking her for her generosity in the last minutes of Jessup's life. He turned to the section where the fallen mentors sat, asked her to stand, and invited the audience to give her a round of applause. Not only did they oblige, but at least half stood up. And while Lysistrata looked embarrassed, he thought she didn't really mind. Then he added that he hoped to properly thank her by fulfilling his prediction that the victor would be a tribute from District 12, namely Lucy Gray. the audience could see for themselves how clever his tribute had been. And they shouldn't forget how she'd stood by Jessup until the bitter end. Again, that was behavior you might expect of a capital girl, but of one from the districts? It was something to think about, how much they rewarded character in the Hunger Games victor, how much she reflected their values. Something must have hit home with the audience, because at least a dozen pings sounded from his communicuff right off. He held up the cuff for the camera and thanked the generous sponsors. As if unable to stand that much attention being showered on Coriolanus, Pup sat forward and loudly announced that he'd better get Lamina her breakfast, and ordered up a storm of food and drink. No one else could compete, as she was the only tribute to be seen in the arena, so it was just one more way in which Pup was annoying. It gratified Coriolanus that no new pinging came from his rival's cuff. Knowing he wouldn't be called upon again until the others had been interviewed, Coriolanus adopted an interested demeanor but barely listened to their pitches. The idea of approaching old Strabo Plinth for money, not blackmailing him, of course, but giving him the opportunity to make a financial gift of thanks, kept nagging at him. What if Coriolanus dropped by the plinth to check on Sejanus's health? That had been a bad cut on his leg. Yes, what if he just dropped by and then saw what happened? Lucky interrupted Io's thoughts on what Cirque might do with the drone.
Well, if the light-emitting diodes on the drone aren't broken, he might be able to fashion a flashlight of some sort, which would give him a great advantage at night,
to direct the audience's attention to Reaper's emergence from the barricade. Lamina, who had been collecting water, bread, and cheese from a half dozen drones, neatly lined up her provisions along the beam. She barely acknowledged Reaper's entrance, but he walked over to her with purpose. He pointed up at the sun and then to her face. For the first time, Coriolanus noticed the toll the long days outdoors were taking on Lamina's skin. She'd been badly sunburned, and her nose was peeling in response. On close inspection, the tops of her bare feet were red as well. Reaper indicated her food. Lamina rubbed her foot and seemed to consider whatever his offer might be. They went back and forth for a bit, then both nodded in agreement. Reaper jogged across the arena and climbed up to the flag of Pan Am. He pulled out his long knife and stabbed through the heavy fabric. Loud objections came from the audience in the hall. This disregard for the sanctity of the national flag shook them. As Reaper began to saw his way through the flag, carving off a piece the size of a small blanket, the unease grew. Surely this should not go unchecked. Surely he should be punished in some way. But given that being in the Hunger Games was the ultimate punishment, no one knew what form it should take. Lepidus hurried over to Clemencia to ask what she made of her tribute's behavior. Well, it's a stupid move, isn't it? Who's going to sponsor him now? Not that it matters, since you never feed him, Pup commented.
I'll feed him when he does something that merits feeding, said Clemencia. Anyway, I think you've got that covered today.
Pup frowned. I do? Clemencia nodded to the screen as Reaper jogged back to the beam. Further negotiation occurred between him and Lamina. Then, on what appeared to be the count of three, Reaper tossed up the wadded piece of flag as Lamina dropped down a piece of bread. The flag didn't quite make it high enough for her to catch hold of. More negotiation ensued. When Reaper finally delivered it after several attempts, she rewarded him with a chunk of cheese. It wasn't an official alliance, but the exchange seemed to bond the two a bit. While Lamina shook out the flag and draped it over her head, Reaper sat against one of the posts and ate his bread and cheese. They didn't speak to each other again, but a relative calm came over them. And when the pack appeared at the far end of the arena, Lamina pointed them out. Reaper gave her a nod of thanks before withdrawing behind the barricade. Coral, Mizzen, and Tanner sat in the stands and made eating motions. Festus, Persephone, and Demetia all obliged them, and the three tributes shared the bread, cheese, and apples dropped by the drones. Back in the studio, Lucky had brought his pet parrot, Jubilee, to the set, and he spent several minutes trying to coax it to say, "Hi, handsome," to Dean Highbottom. The bird, a depressed creature in the midst of battling mange, perched wordlessly on Lucky's wrist as the dean folded his hands and waited.
Oh, say it. Come on. Hi, handsome. Hi, handsome.
I don't think it wants to, Lucky, said Dean Highbottom finally. Perhaps it doesn't find me handsome at all.
What? Ha! No! He's just shy in front of strangers.
He held out the bird. Would you like to hold him?
The dean leaned back. No.
Lucky pulled Jubilee back to his chest and stroked his feathers with a fingertip.
So, Dean Highbottom, what do you make of it all?
All what? Dean Highbottom asked.
All this stuff, all this different stuff happening in the Hunger Games.
Lucky waved his hand in the air.
All of it.
Well, what I'm noticing is the new interactivity of the games, said Dean Highbottom.
Lucky nodded.
Interactivity. Go on.
Right from the beginning, even before, actually, when the bombing occurred in the arena, it not only took out participants, it changed the landscape, the dean continued.
Changed the landscape,
Lucky repeated.
Yes, now we have the barricade, the beam, access to the tunnels. It's a brand new arena, and it's made the tributes behave in a brand new way, the dean explained.
And we have drones, said Lucky.
Exactly right. Now the audience is an active player in the games.
Dean Highbottom inclined his head toward Lucky.
And you know what that means.
What?
Said Lucky. The dean spoke the next word slowly, as if to a small child.
It means we're all in the arena together, Lucky.
Lucky furrowed his brow.
Huh. I don't quite get that.
Dean Highbottom tapped his temple with his forefinger.
Think it over.
Hi, handsome,
squawked Jubilee despondently.
Oh, there we go. I told you, didn't I? Crowed Lucky.
You did, admitted the dean, and yet it was still unexpected.
Nothing much else happened before lunch. Lucky did the weather report district by district with the added fillip of Jubilee's company, but the bird refused to talk again, so Lucky began speaking for it in a high-pitched voice.
How's the weather look in District 12, Jubilee?
They've got snow, Lucky.
Snow in July, Jubilee?
Coriolanus snow.
Coriolanus gave the camera a thumbs up when they cut for his reaction. He could not believe this was his life. Lunch disappointed as the menu consisted of nut butter sandwiches, and he'd had nut butter for breakfast. He ate it because he ate anything free, and it was important to keep his strength up. A ripple went through the hall, indicating something was happening on the screen, and he hurried to resume his seat. Maybe Lucy Gray had surfaced? She had not, but the pack's morning laziness had given way to direction. The three strode across the arena until they were directly under Lamina's beam. She took no notice at first, but Tanner smacking a sword blade against one of the poles brought her to attention. Lamina sat up and surveyed the pack, and she must have sensed a change in the air because she pulled out her axe and her knife and polished them on the flag. After a brief huddle, in which the District 4 tributes relinquished their tridents to Tanner, the pack split up. Coral and Mizzen each went to one of the metal posts that supported the beam, and Tanner stood directly under Lamina, holding the pair of tridents. Knives in teeth, Coral and Mizzen gave each other a nod, and then began to climb their respective posts. Festus shifted in his seat.
Here we go.
They'll never make it,
said Pup in agitation.
They're trained to work on ships. They climb ropes as part of it, Persephone pointed out.
Rigging, said Festus.
Yes, I get it. My father's a commander, after all, said Pup. Rope climbing is different. The posts are more like trees.
But Pup had been getting on everyone's nerves, and even the mentors without a tribute in the confrontation seemed eager to comment.
What about masts? Asked Vipsania.
Or flagpoles,
Urban chimed in.
They won't make it, said Pup.
While the District 4 pair lacked Lamina's smooth style, they were indeed making it, slowly pulling their way higher and higher. Tanner directed them, calling on Coral to wait a moment when Mizzen fell behind.
Look,
They're timing it so they reach the top together, said Io. They're making her choose who to fight. Then the other one will reach the beam.
So she'll kill one of them and climb down, said Pup.
Where Tanner will be waiting, Coriolanus reminded him.
Well, I know that, said Pup. What do you expect me to do? It's not like they have rabies and there's a simple fix, like sitting in water.
Never would have crossed your mind, said Festus.
Of course it would have, snapped Pup. Shut up, all of you.
A silence fell, but largely because Coral and Mizzen were nearing the top. Lamina's head went back and forth as she decided who to confront. Then she headed for Coral.
No, not the girl, the boy, exclaimed Pup, jumping to his feet. Now she'll have to fight the boy on the beam.
I'd do the same thing. I wouldn't want to fight that girl up there, said Demetia,
and murmurs of agreement came from a few of the mentors.
No, Pup reconsidered.
Maybe you're right.
Lamina reached the end of the beam and swung the axe down at Coral without hesitation, just missing her scalp but shaving off a tuft of hair. Coral retreated, lowering herself about a yard, but Lamina struck at her a few more times, as if to drive the point home. As expected, this gave Mizzen time to mount the beam.
But when Tanner threw the trident up to him, it peaked about two-thirds of the way up and fell back to the ground.
Lamina took one last swipe at Coral and then moved swiftly for Mizzen. He was no match for her sure-footedness on the beam, and only managed a few hesitant steps as she bore down on him. Tanner did better with his second throw, but the trident bounced off the underside of the beam and landed in the dirt. Occupied by crouching to try and catch it, Mizzen straightened up just as Lamina came in, bringing the flat side of the axe against the outer part of his knee. The force of the blow threw them both off balance, but while she recovered by straddling the beam, Mizzen fell, losing his knife and just barely catching himself with one arm. Even the sound system in the arena picked up Coral's war cry as she gained the top. Tanner ran down to her end and managed to hurl the trident within range. The easy way Coral snatched the weapon from the air drew a few exclamations of admiration from the capital audience. Lamina gave Mizzen a glance, but his helpless condition posed no immediate threat, so she turned and braced herself for Coral's attack. Lamina had better balance, but Coral's weapon had more range. After Lamina managed to block the first few jabs with her axe, Coral wove the trident in a twisting move that distracted the eye before it plunged into her opponent's abdomen. Coral released the weapon and stepped back, using her knife as a backup, but none was needed. Lamina fell off the beam and died on impact.
No!
Cried Pup, and the word echoed around Heavensby Hall. He stood stock still for a long moment, then picked up his seat and left the mentor section, ignoring Lepidus's outstretched mic. He slammed his chair down next to Livia's and strode out of the hall. Coriolanus thought he was trying not to cry. Coral crossed to Mizzen and stood over him for a disconcerting beat, in which Coriolanus wondered if she was planning to kick his arm free and send him after Lamina. Instead, she sat down on the beam, locking her legs for support, and helped him to safety. The axe had damaged his knee, although it was difficult to gauge to what extent. He half slid, half lowered himself down the pole, closely followed by Coral, who picked up the unused trident from the ground where Tanner had abandoned it. Mizzen leaned back against the pole, testing his knee. After performing some kind of dance over Lamina's body, Tanner bounded over to them. Mizzen grinned and raised his hands for a victory slap. Tanner had just made contact when Coral drove the second trident into his back. He fell forward into Mizzen, who, braced by the pole, shoved him away. Tanner turned in a circle, one hand swatting uselessly behind him as if to dislodge the trident, but the barbed tines were buried deep. He fell to his knees, his expression more wounded than shocked, and collapsed face down in the dirt. Mizzen finished him with a knife to the neck. He then went back and sat against his pole, while Coral tore a strip of fabric from Lamina's flag cloth and began to bind his knee. At the studio, Lucky's face stretched into a comedic mask of shock.
Did you just see what I saw?
Demetia had quietly gathered her things, her lips pressed together in disappointment. But when Lepidus pushed the mic at her, she spoke in a calm, detached voice.
It's a surprise. I thought Tanner might win this thing, and he probably would have if his allies hadn't betrayed him. I guess that's the takeaway. Be careful who you trust.
In and out of the arena, said Lepidus, nodding sagely.
Everywhere,
Demetia agreed.
You know, Tanner was a very good-natured sort of person, and District 4 took advantage of that.
She looked sadly at Festus and Persephone, suggesting this reflected badly on them, and Lepidus gave a disapproving click of his tongue.
It's one of the many things I've learned from being a mentor in the Hunger Games. I'll always cherish my experience here, and I wish all the remaining mentors the best of luck.
Well said, Demetia. I think you've just showed your fellow mentors how to be a good loser, said Lepidus. Lucky? The cut revealed Lucky trying to lure Jubilee off the chandelier with a cracker. What? Aren't you going to talk to the other one? What's his name? The commander's kid?
He declined to comment, said Lepidus.
Well, let's get back to the show, called Lucky. The show was over for the moment, though. Coral finished bandaging Mizzen's knee and collected their tridents, yanking them from her victim's bodies. Mizzen limped as the pair walked unhurriedly across the arena to their preferred tunnel. Citeria came over and had the mentors rearrange their chairs into two neat rows of four. Io, Urban, Clemencia, and Vipsania in the front, Coriolanus, Festus, Persephone, and Hilarius in the back. The musical chairs continued. Perhaps the indignities of being Lucky's dummy had become too great, because Jubilee refused to come down from the chandelier. Lucky leaned heavily on his stringers in Heavensby Hall and in front of the arena, where the crowd had set up cheering sections for the various tributes. Team Lucy Gray was well represented by young and old, male and female, and even a handful of Avoxes, but they didn't really count, having been brought along to hold signs. Coriolanus wished Lucy Gray could see how many people loved her. He wished she knew how he advocated for her. He'd become more active, pulling Lepidus over during quiet stretches and praising Lucy Gray to the skies. As a result, her sponsor gifts had reached a new high, and he felt confident he could feed her for a week. There was really nothing left to do but watch and wait. Treach came out long enough to snag Lamina's axe and for Vipsania to feed him. Tessaly retrieved another fallen drone and collected some food from Urban. Little else occurred until late afternoon, when Reaper wandered out of the barricade, rubbing sleep from his eyes. He seemed unable to make sense of the scene before him, the stabbed bodies of Tanner and particularly Lamina. After walking around them for a time, he lifted Lamina up, carried her over to where Bobbin and Marcus lay, and arranged the three in a row on the ground. For a while he paced around the beam, then he dragged Tanner over beside Lamina. Over the next hour, he collected first Dill and then Sol, adding them to his makeshift morgue. Jessup remained the only one left out. Reaper was probably afraid of contracting rabies. Once he'd neatly lined up the others, he swatted at the flies that had gathered. After pausing a moment in thought, he went back and cut off a second piece of the flag, draping it over their bodies and causing another wave of outrage in the hall. Reaper shook out Lamina's flag remnant and tied it like a cape around his shoulders. The cape seemed to inspire him, and he began to spin slowly, looking back over his shoulder to watch it fly out behind him. He ran then, spreading his arms out as the flag streamed in the sunlight. Exhausted by the day's activities, he finally climbed into the stands and waited.
Oh, for heaven's sake, feed him, Clemmy, said Festus.
Mind your own business, said Clemencia.
You're heartless, Festus told her.
I'm a good manager. It could be a long Hunger Games.
She gave Coriolanus an unpleasant smile.
And it's not like I've abandoned him.
Coriolanus thought about inviting her to the Citadel for his follow-up appointment. He could use some company, and she could visit her snakes. 5 o'clock rolled around with the dismissal of the student body, and the 8 remaining mentors gathered for beef stew and cake.
He couldn't say he missed Domitia, and certainly not Pup, but he missed the buffer they had provided between him and the likes of Clemencia, Vipsania, and Urban.
Even Hilarius, with his woeful tales of being a Heavensbee, had become a strain. When Citeria released them around 8 o'clock, he headed straight for the door, hoping it wasn't too late to have his arm checked. The Citadel guards recognized him, and after they searched his book bag, he was allowed to keep it and go down to the lab unescorted. He wandered a bit before finding his destination, then sat in the clinic for 30 minutes before a doctor appeared. She checked his vitals, examined the stitches, which were doing their job, and told him to wait. An unusual energy filled the lab. Quick footsteps, raised voices, impatient commands. Coriolanus listened hard, but he couldn't make out the cause of the activity. He did hear the words arena and games more than once, and wondered about the connection. When Dr. Gall finally appeared, she made only a cursory check of his stitches.
"Another few days," she confirmed. "Tell me, Mr. Snow, did you know Gaius Breen?"
"Did I?" asked Coriolanus, picking up on the past tense immediately. "I do. I mean, we're classmates. I know he lost his legs in the arena. Is he—"
"He's dead. Complications from the bombing," said Dr. Gall.
"Oh, no." Coriolanus couldn't process it. Gaius dead? Gaius Breen? He remembered a joke Gaius had recently told him about how many rebels it took to tie a shoe. "I never even visited him in the hospital. When is the funeral?"
"That's being worked out. You must keep it to yourself until we make an official announcement," she warned him. "I'm only telling you now so that at least one of you will have something intelligent to say to Lepidus. I trust you can manage that."
"Yes, of course. That will be strange. Announcing it during the games, like a victory for the rebels," said Coriolanus.
"Exactly. But rest assured there will be repercussions. In fact, it was your girl who gave me the idea. If she wins, we should compare notes. And I haven't forgotten, you owe me a paper."
She left, pulling the curtain closed behind her. Free to go, Coriolanus buttoned his shirt up and collected his book bag. What was he supposed to write about again? Something about chaos, control, contracts? He felt fairly sure it began with a C. When he approached the elevator, he found a pair of lab assistants ahead of him, trying to maneuver a cart into the car. On the cart sat the large tank filled with the snakes that had attacked Clemencia.
"Did she say to bring the cooler?" asked one of the assistants.
"Not that I remember," said the other. "I thought they'd been fed. We better check. If we're wrong, she'll go ballistic."
She noticed Coriolanus.
"Sorry, need to back out."
"No problem," he said and stepped aside so they could wheel the tank out. The elevator doors closed, and he could hear the whir of it ascending.
"Oh, sorry. It will be back in a minute,"
the second assistant said. "No problem," Coriolanus repeated. But he was beginning to suspect a very great problem. He thought of the activity in the lab and the games being mentioned, and Dr. Gall promising repercussions. "Where are you taking the snakes?" he asked as innocently as possible. "Oh, just to another lab," said one, but the assistants exchanged a look. "Come on, the cooler takes two." The pair receded into the lab, leaving him alone with the tank.
"In fact, it was your girl who gave me the idea."
His girl, Lucy Gray, who'd made an entrance into the Hunger Games by dropping a snake down the mayor's daughter's back.
"If she wins, we should compare notes."
"Notes about what? How to use snakes as weapons?" He stared into the undulating reptiles, imagining them being let loose in the arena. What would they do? Hide? Hunt? Attack? Even if he knew how snakes behaved, which he didn't, he doubted these would conform to any norms, as they were genetically designed by Dr. Gall. With a sharp pang, Coriolanus had a vision of Lucy Gray in their final meeting, clutching his hand as he promised her they could win.
but there was no way he could protect her from the creatures in this tank, any more than he could protect her from tridents and swords. At least she could hide from those. He didn't know for sure, but he was guessing the snakes would head straight for the tunnels. The dark would not impair their sense of smell. They would not recognize Lucy Gray's scent, just the way they had not recognized Clemencia's. Lucy Gray would scream and fall to the ground, her lips turning purple, then bloodless, while bright pink and blue and yellow pus oozed onto her ruffled dress. That was it. The thing the snakes had reminded him of the first time he'd seen them. They matched her dress, as if they had always been her destiny. Without knowing quite how, Coriolanus found the handkerchief in his hand, neatly balled up like a prop in one of Lucky's magic tricks. He moved to the snake tank, his back to the security camera, and leaned over, resting his hands on the cover as if fascinated by the snakes. From that vantage point, he watched the handkerchief fall through the trap door and disappear beneath the rainbow of bodies.
Chapter 19. What had he done? What on earth had he done? His heart raced as he blindly turned down one street and then another, trying to make sense of his actions. He couldn't think clearly, but had the dreadful feeling that he'd crossed some line that could not be uncrossed. The avenue felt full of eyes. There were few pedestrians or drivers out, but even their notice felt glaring. Coriolanus ducked into a park and hid in the shadows, on a bench surrounded by bushes. He forced himself to control his breathing, counting four in and four out until his blood stopped pounding in his ears. Then he tried to think rationally. All right, so he dropped the handkerchief with Lucy Gray's scent, the one from the outside pocket of his book bag, into the snake tank. He'd done it so they would not bite her as they had Clemencia, so they would not kill her, because he cared about her. Because he cared about her? Or because he wanted her to win the Hunger Games so that he could secure the plinth prize? If it was the latter, he had cheated to win, and that was that. Hold on. You didn't know if those snakes were going to the arena, he thought. The assistants had, in fact, told him otherwise. There was no history of such a thing ever occurring. Perhaps it had just been a temporary flight of madness. And even if the snakes did end up in the arena, Lucy Gray might never encounter them. It was a huge place, and he didn't think snakes just went around attacking people right and left. You had to step on them or something. And even if she did run into a snake and it didn't bite her, how would anyone trace that back to him? It required too much high-security knowledge and access that no one would presume he had. And a handkerchief with her scent. And why would he have that? It was okay. He was going to be okay. Except that line. Whether anyone pieced together his actions or not, he knew he had crossed it. In fact, he knew he'd been dancing on top of it for some time.
Like when he'd taken Sejanus's food from the dining hall to feed Lucy Gray.
It had been a small infraction, motivated by his desire to keep her alive and his anger at the game maker's negligence. An argument could be made for basic decency there, but it was not a lone incident. He could see it all now, the slippery slope of the last few weeks that had started with Sejanus's leftovers and ended with him here, shivering in the dark on a deserted park bench. What awaited him farther down that slope if he was unable to stop his descent? What else might he be capable of? Well, that was it. It stopped now. If he didn't have honor, he had nothing. No more deception, no more shady strategies, no more rationalization. From now on, he'd live honestly. And if he ended up as a beggar, at least he would be a decent one. His feet had carried him far from home, but he realized the plinth apartment was just a few minutes away. Why not pop in? An Avox in a maid's outfit opened the door and gestured to ask if she should take his book bag. He declined and inquired if Sejanus was free. She led him to a drawing room and indicated that he should sit. While he waited, he took in the furnishings with a knowing eye. Fine furniture, thick carpets,
embroidered tapestries, a bronze bust of someone. While the exterior of the apartment had not impressed, no expense had been spared on the interior. All the plinths needed was an address on the corso to solidify their status. Mrs. Plinth bustled in, full of apologies and flour. Sejanus, it seemed, had gone to bed early and he'd caught her in the kitchen. Would he come downstairs for a moment and have a cup of tea? Or perhaps she should serve tea in here, like the Snows had. No, no, he assured her. The kitchen would be fine. As if anyone served a guest in the kitchen but a plinth. But he had not come to pass judgment. He had come to be thanked, and if that involved baked goods, all the better.
Would you like pie? I've got blackberry, or peach if you can wait for it.
She nodded to a pair of newly assembled pies on the counter awaiting the oven.
Or maybe cake? I made custards this afternoon. The Avoxes like those best because, you know, they're easy to swallow. Coffee or tea or milk?
The lines between Ma's eyebrows deepened in anxiety, as if nothing she could offer would be good enough. Although he'd eaten dinner, the events at the Citadel and the walk had left him drained. Oh, milk, please. And the blackberry pie would be a real treat. No one can compete with your cooking. Ma filled a large glass to the brim. She carved out a full quarter of the pie and plunked it onto a plate.
Do you like ice cream? She asked.
Several scoops of vanilla followed. She pulled a chair up to the surprisingly simple wooden table. It sat under a framed needlepoint of a mountain scene overlaid with a single word. Home.
My sister sent me that. She's the only one I really stay in touch with now. Or who stays in touch with me, I guess. Doesn't really fit with the rest of the house, but I have my own corner down here. Please, sit. Eat.
Her corner boasted the table with three mismatched chairs, the needlepoint, and a shelf filled with little oddities. A pair of rooster salt and pepper shakers, a marble egg, and a soft doll with patched clothing. The sum total of the possessions, Coriolanus suspected, that she'd brought from home. Her shrine to District 2. It was pitiful the way she clung to that backward mountain region. Poor little displaced person without a hope of ever fitting in, spending her days making custards for Avoxes who would never taste them, and pining for the past. He watched her slide the pies into the oven and took a bite of his slice. His taste buds tingled in pleasure.
How is it? She asked anxiously.
Superb, he said. Like everything you cook, Mrs. Plinth. It wasn't an exaggeration. Ma might be pathetic, but she was something of an artist in the kitchen. She allowed herself a small smile and joined him at the table.
Well, if you ever want seconds, our door is always open. I don't even know how to begin to thank you, Coriolanus, for what you've done for us. Sejanus is my life. I'm sorry he can't visit with you. He's taken a lot of that sedative. Can't seem to sleep otherwise. So angry. So lost. Well, I don't have to tell you how unhappy he is.
The capital isn't really the best fit for him, said Coriolanus.
For any of us plinths, really. Strabo says that while it's hard for us now, it will be better for Sejanus and his children, but I don't know.
She glanced up at her shelf.
Your family and friends, that's your real life, Coriolanus. And we left all ours back in two. But you know that already. I can see it. I'm glad you've got your grandma and that sweet cousin.
Coriolanus found himself trying to cheer her up, saying that things would be better once Sejanus graduated from the academy. The university had more people and more kinds of people from all over the capital, and he was sure to make new friends. Mrs. Plinth nodded but didn't seem convinced. The Avox maid caught her attention and communicated in a kind of sign language.
All right, he'll come up after he finishes his pie, Mrs. Plinth told her. My husband would like to see you, if you don't mind. I think he wants to thank you.
When Coriolanus swallowed his last bite of pie, he bid Ma good night and followed the maid up the stairs to the main floor. The thick carpeting silenced their footsteps, so they arrived at the open library door without warning, and he was able to get a look at Strabo Plinth with his guard down. The man stood at a fancy stone fireplace, his tall frame propped up by an elbow on the mantel, staring down into where the flame would be in another season. Now the hearth was cold and empty, and Coriolanus had to wonder what he saw there that would provoke the profoundly sad expression on his face. One hand gripped the velvet lapel of his expensive smoking jacket, which seemed all wrong, like Mrs. Plinth's designer dress or Sejanus's suit. The Plinth's wardrobe always suggested they were trying too hard to be capital. The unquestionable quality of the clothes clashed with their district personae instead of disguising them, just as the grandmam in a flower sack dress would still scream corso. Mr. Plinth met his gaze, and Coriolanus felt a sensation he remembered from encounters with his own father, a mix of anxiety and awkwardness, as if at that moment he'd been caught doing something foolish. This man, however, was a Plinth, not a Snow. Coriolanus produced his best society smile. "Good evening, Mr. Plinth. I'm not disturbing you?"
"Not at all. Come in, sit."
Mr. Plinth gestured to the leather chairs before the fireplace rather than the ones before his imposing oak desk. This was to be personal then, not business.
"You've eaten? Of course you couldn't get out of the kitchen without my wife stuffing you like a turkey. Do you want a drink? A whiskey, maybe?"
Adults had never offered him any beverage stronger than Posca, which went quickly enough to his head. He couldn't risk that for this exchange. "I don't know where I'd put it," he said with a laugh, patting his stomach as he settled himself into a chair. "But please, you go ahead."
"Oh, I don't drink."
Mr. Plinth folded himself into the facing chair and looked Coriolanus over.
"You look like your father."
"I hear that a lot," said Coriolanus.
"Did you know him?"
"Our business overlapped at times." He drummed his long fingers on the arm of the chair.
"It's striking, the resemblance. But you're nothing like him, really."
"No," thought Coriolanus. "I'm poor and powerless." Although maybe the perceived difference was good for tonight's purposes. His district-hating father would have loathed seeing Strabo Plinth admitted to the capital and becoming a titan of the munitions industry. That was not why he'd given his life in the war.
"Nothing at all.
Or you'd never have gone into that arena after my son," continued Mr. Plinth. "Impossible to imagine Crassus Snow risking his life for me. I keep asking myself why you did it."
"Not much choice, really," thought Coriolanus.
"He's my friend," he said.
"No matter how many times I hear that, it's difficult to believe. But even from the beginning, Sejanus singled you out. Maybe you take after your mother, huh? She was always gracious to me when I came here on business before the war, despite my background. The very definition of a lady. Never forgot it." He gave Coriolanus a hard stare. "Are you like your mother?" The conversation wasn't going the way Coriolanus had imagined. Where was the talk of reward money? He couldn't be persuaded to take it if it was never offered. "I'd like to think I am, in some respects."
"In what respects?" asked Mr. Plinth. The line of questioning felt weird. In what way was he anything like that loving, adoring creature who'd sung him to sleep each night?
"Well, we shared a fondness for music."
"Did they?" She liked music, and he didn't hate it, he guessed.
"Music, huh?"
said Mr. Plinth, as if Coriolanus had said something as frivolous as puffy clouds. "And I do think we both believed that good fortune was something to be repaid on a daily basis, not taken for granted," he added. He had no idea what that meant, but it seemed to register with Mr. Plinth. He thought it over.
"I'd agree with that."
"Oh, good. Yes, well, so, Sejanus," Coriolanus reminded him. Mr. Plinth's face grew weary.
"Sejanus, thank you, by the way, for saving his life."
"No thanks necessary. As I said, he's my friend." Now was the time. The time for the money, the refusal, the persuasion,